listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Grace Upon Grace, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, January 20th, 2019.
I had a very respectable, not very interesting sermon planned for this week. And then on Friday night, a small group of us joined a large group of other people at Congregation Beth Israel for their Martin Luther King weekend Shabbat service. The guest speaker was Brian Stevenson, a lawyer, author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. I wish that I could simply bring you a videotape of the prayers that opened that service and the words that Mr. Stevenson spoke, because the evening was so powerful. I do urge you to Google his name, find his TED Talk, or an earlier version of the talk he gave on Friday night. His speech on how to change the world. I promise you, you will be heartened. In the meantime, I want to share just a little bit of what I heard, how it lifted me, and how it helped me read this week's gospel. As he said on Friday night, and as he wrote this weekend in an online movie review, in 1974, there were fewer than 300,000 people in American jails and prisons. Today, in 2019, 2.2 million people are incarcerated in the United States. In racially segregated communities of color with high concentrations of poverty, there is an expectation that more than half of all young black men will be imprisoned by the criminal justice system at some point in their lives. Many will be falsely accused, wrongly convicted, or unfairly sentenced, devastating families and communities. Brian Stevenson has found his life work, his calling, working to change this reality. He works to change the world by advocating for cultural change, political change, and by working one by one on cases of people wrongly convicted and unfairly sentenced. He does this on his own as a lawyer and with the organization that he founded, the Equal Justice Initiative. He has, and he shared with us, four guiding principles that keep him centered and empowered to do this urgent work, this urgent and sometimes overwhelming work. And on this Martin Luther King weekend, he invited the interfaith, multiracial congregation that had gathered to be guided and encouraged by these same four points, four things to help us change the world. The first principle is that we need to stay proximate, to get proximate to the people we care about who are suffering, the poor, the hungry, the exiled or displaced, those who are in jail or prison. We cannot serve people if we don't get close to them. We cannot see what they are actually experiencing from across the city or even from the other side of the street. We cannot listen from far away. So move in close. Hold people close. His second goal is to change the narratives of fear and anger that we have allowed to define people in our culture. If we want to change the narratives that are false, we have to first acknowledge the narratives that we as an American community live by and admit that many of them are false. As Stevenson pointed out, after slavery ended, we officially stopped telling the lie that African people are not human in the same way that people of European descent are, that they don't have the same intellectual, moral, or emotional capabilities, and therefore were natural candidates for enslavement. But the moment we stopped telling that lie, we replaced it with the lie that black and brown people have a greater propensity to be criminal than white people do. We replaced it with a presumption of dangerousness and guilt. And the policy that springs from that lie is that black and brown people should be both policed and punished more harshly than white people. We cannot stop telling this lie until we admit to ourselves that we have fallen prey to it, that at some level we bought into it. It's a powerful lie, and it's been working on us for a long time. But we can overcome it. So we must be honest with ourselves about this and all the other lies that our culture has taught us, and work diligently to help change the narratives to something that is more true. The third principle is to guard your hope. The work of justice, the work of building the beloved community, is long and often discouraging. And without hope under us, we may fall away. Hopelessness is the enemy of justice. Hopefulness is the enemy of justice. So guard your hope. And finally, in order to change the world, to work for the beloved community that Martin Luther King Jr. preached about, and the kingdom of the Spirit that Jesus promised, in order to be part of this work, we must be willing to do uncomfortable and inconvenient things. During February, we're going to reflect on those four points one by one: getting and staying proximate, changing narratives, guarding our hope, and being willing to do uncomfortable and inconvenient things for the sake of building the beloved community, for the sake of changing the world, for the sake of following in the way of Jesus. In the meantime, in the next couple of weeks, I do encourage you to Google Brian Stevenson and listen to that TED Talk or any of the YouTube recordings of him online. Or if you are so inclined, pick up his beautiful book, Just Mercy. For today, I want to turn back to that third point, guard your hope, because it helped open up today's gospel story for me. Just a few minutes ago, I read the story of Jesus turning the water into wine at the wedding at Cana. A very familiar story. And here we are in the season of Epiphany, when the church traditionally celebrates moments when Jesus' identity was shown forth. The arrival of the Magi, when Jesus was acknowledged by foreign dignitaries and threatened by Herod. The baptism of Jesus, and the declaration of his and our belovedness. And now today, the wedding story, when at least a few people saw his glory and believed in him. This story appears only in John's gospel, where it serves as the first of seven important signs that reveal Jesus's identity and mission, a holy and important doorway into knowing who Jesus is. But I have a confession. This story usually strikes me as, well, a little bit frivolous. Changing water into wine seems more like a party trick than an act of one sent to be the messenger and presence of God for the people. And the fact that it's really good wine, given for people described as already drunk, well, that doesn't strike me as holy or even as especially healthy. But being in the presence of such holy passion on Friday evening and being encouraged to hang on to hope had me listening to the story again with fresh ears. So here we go. Here's Jesus, still a relatively young rabbi, just setting out on his mission and not yet well known. Not well known even as close to his hometown of Nazareth as Cana, just 9 miles down the road. This little-known Jesus, his newly called disciples, and his mother were all invited to a wedding in that little town of Cana. And in the middle of the festivities, the wine ran out. Now, there are several historical things to keep in mind. In that time period, water was most often not potable. You couldn't drink the stuff. So running out of wine might indeed have left the guests with nothing at all to drink. In addition, in the ancient world, This kind of shortage was more than just an inconvenience. Wedding celebrations went on for days, even up to a week. And wine was considered an essential mark of hospitality. Running out of wine would be a major embarrassment for the host family. What's more, wedding guests often brought wine and food as a contribution to the days of revelry. So a shortage might indicate that both the host and the guests lacked resources. It was a shameful moment. Perhaps Mary was related to the bride or to the groom because she became aware that the wine had run dry, and she called on Jesus to act. Jesus was just short of rude with her. What's that got to do with us? My hour has not yet come. There are echoes, of course, in this use of my hour to Jesus' hour of suffering, trial, and death much later in his story. We are reminded, right in the middle of a story of seeming sweetness, that the mission he is starting is one that will lead to difficult and dangerous places. But Mary is having none of his reluctance. She tells the servants to do whatever Jesus asks them to do. After the manner of mothers throughout time, she gives Jesus the silent message, "You are ready. You got this. I believe in you." And like children throughout time who love and trust their mothers, having been encouraged, Jesus acts. He doesn't go to either the bride or the groom or their families. He doesn't even go to the head steward. He goes to the servants and tells them to fill the stone water jars, jars that were probably emptied of their water earlier in the day or the week, as the guests performed the ritual washing required before eating. "Refill those with water," Jesus says, "and when you've done that, draw some out and take it to the head steward." The steward has no idea where this drink came from, though clearly the servants do, and he assumes that the groom has been holding back this excellent wine until now, a rare feat of hospitality. Most people would have served the bad stuff first and saved the good stuff till later in the celebration when people's palates had been dulled by food and drink. Jesus has taken the water jars, symbols of purity and the fulfillment of the law, and had them filled to overflowing. 150 or more gallons worth of overflowing. With wine. Wine, the ancient Hebrew symbol of restoration and the new era to come. The symbol of the feast of joy and gladness that will usher in the realm of God. The feast to which all of God's children will be invited. The feast that we look forward to and have a foretaste of when we come to communion. And this symbol of the coming banquet is absolutely overflowing. It's not a small reminder, but a vivid sign of abundance for the sake of joyful community. Now, wine may not be that symbol for you. Perhaps for you, wine is a symbol of burden and entrapment. Replace it with another symbol of celebration and freedom. The richest fruits, something in that world or this that is rare, sweet, and overflowing. Grapes and pomegranates, oranges and mangoes. And imagine them being provided in great, abundant heaps and piles so that everyone at the table may be refreshed and filled with goodness and sweetness. This is what the realm of God tastes like. This is abundance for the sake of joy. Not just joy one by one, but joy in community. And it is also a glimpse into the abundant life at the heart of Jesus' mission. And to whom is this abundant life first announced? Well, Mary is in on it, of course, and the disciples see it as a revelation of glory, and they believe even more deeply in this fellow they've just started following. But outside of that inner circle, it isn't the mayor of the town. It isn't the leaders of the local synagogue. It isn't even the host family, whoever they were, or the head steward in his position of authority and respect. No, it is to the kind of servants who are asked to do the heavy lifting, the ones expected to schlep 150 gallons of water. I don't know how many of you ever carry water, but it weighs about 8 pounds a gallon. 20 or 30 gallons per jar, plus the weight of the jar itself, I'm not sure how they even lifted them. Maybe they filled 5-gallon buckets and made trip after trip to the well. Either way, grunt work. And it was these servants, the ones doing that heavy lifting, that grunt work, that were in on this sign of Jesus' glory. And they were in on his mission of abundance and the preservation of hospitality. Jesus' mission is about declaring the dawn of a new era of restoration, long promised and now close by, a day of abundance. Copious fine wine unexpectedly appearing in a context of sudden scarcity is a foretaste of what the new era will be like. It will surprise and gladden us. It will overflow expected limitations. The upshot of the new era will be joy and celebration and community. And it will be a community in which those who are the servants will come in first. Because this will be an era of justice. The good news is not addressed first to the rich and the powerful, the well-to-do families with their already full banqueting tables. This news is for the vulnerable and the disinherited, the lowly servants at the modest weddings that run out of wine. Grace flows and hope is restored, not from the top down, but from the bottom up. This banquet that foretells and belongs to the beloved community is obviously not here yet. But we know what shape it will take. It's so close that even now we can see it and taste it and touch it and then share it. There's something else in this odd story of turning water into wine. It reminded me that some miracles take hard work. We think of a miracle as a flash and something is done. But the story of water turning into wine only happened because Mary noticed the need. The story only continued because the servants toted all that water, one way or another. The story only concluded because the steward proclaimed the goodness of what he tasted, and the disciples paid attention to what they were hearing. In a world that is chaotic, where we are called upon to notice with Mary where the needs of the world are, in a world that is discouraging, where we are called upon to carry heavy loads, even when we don't yet know the outcome of the work we are doing, in this world where we are both divided and disconnected across religious, political, and racial lines, in this world, we are given the sign of God's abundance, that grace upon grace will be ours, that we are not wrong to live in hope, that we are not wrong to guard our hope by giving and receiving acts of hospitality. We are not wrong to keep our eyes and hearts lifted to the fact that life itself is an abundant gift, and we get to be here in it together, guarding each other's hope, encouraging each other on the way, and listening for the voice of the Spirit, calling us inward, propelling us outward, leading us to the day when the beloved community will be realized.
Listen, listen, listen.